tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world. Have you noticed how many people today just don't care anymore? They just don't seem to get excited about anything because they're convinced nothing's going to work out all right. Almost no involvement with the big issues of life, no direct concern about personal or national goals. Why so much public lethargy? Thinkers, government leaders, historians, many college professors, those who try to find what is the pulse of modern trends and changes and where is this world going are concerned. When you take a look at our age and analyze it in the light of some of the ancient empires and at the trends that were evident in, say, ancient Persia, Greece, or Rome prior to their collapse, you find apathy, public lethargy, and unconcern in those ancient governments as well. And viewing it nationally, it's like a sickness or a disease. In Britain, people scurry for the exits prior to the singing of God Save the Queen from public places, notably, of course, their cinema or theaters or motion picture theaters, as we call them in the United States. Recently here in Pasadena, California, they had the annual Rose Parade, the New Year's spectacle, but of course nobody's going to allow anything to interfere with Sunday, and so it came on a Monday. And you notice that even though some people will come into the area of Pasadena 2 and even 3 days in advance, if you can believe it. Now, the parade lasts, oh, I guess a couple of hours or so, but these people were sometimes 72 hours on the streets in a camper or the back of a trailer or a truck with their sleeping bags and their utensils and what have you, camping out on people's front yards or just on public streets, waiting to see with their eye a parade. I couldn't help but notice this year, as I have in all past years, it's impressed upon me, and it seems to get worse year by year, that more than ever before, thousands of those people were totally reluctant to stand when the United States flag went by. Here were Max Palomino horses and the rum-tum of the drums and a U.S. Marine Corps band marching in their snappy dressed blue uniforms. And here were thousands of people who had been waiting there through the chilly pre-dawn hours to ogle the parade, but who would not get disturbed enough about the symbol of their nation and the great country that's given them all of their personal freedoms and privileges and blessings to get on their feet when the flag goes by. It's also noticed that when public entertainers are called upon for the national anthem or the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, you know, they sometimes can't remember the words. I remember one time at a professional basketball game when a Hollywood figure walked out in the middle of the court and stood before the microphone and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, will you all join me in the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag?" and then couldn't remember the words. The next two or three figures I saw do the same thing had either a huge placard or else a folded piece of paper with the words of the national anthem on them. Usually when they say, "Would you join me in singing the national anthem?" I join them in singing. Six or eight people ahead of me turn around and look as if, "What kind of a nut is that? He's actually singing the national anthem." It's amazing at how people refuse to stand for something today. Figuratively and literally, they refuse to stand when the flag goes by, and they refuse to stand for any important issue to them. Why? Why this lack of personal and national interest? This sense of direction? Any sense of personal involvement with issues? Why this assurance on the part of so many that there's no need to worry, nothing's going to work out all right? Well, I'll tell you why, because most people are simply convinced that there is no good news ahead. They've been told by leaders that there is nothing more to expect than more problems, insoluble, most of them, more wars, more hate, more violence. You look at our jokes and they're sick, our entertainment and it's violent, our literature is morose, brooding, moody, and hopeless. And so millions seek temporary escapes into hallucinogens and drunken dreams, LSD and booze, or escape from their geographical location because they're convinced that the reality of some other place is better than the reality of here. And people simply can't cope with the world the way it is. They wonder if the world is still going to be here tomorrow, and they're not sure. In the words of many of our leaders, as I've been quoting in recent programs, they tell us to get used to a long haul over a very crooked and torturous road to an uncertain goal that we can never be convinced we will achieve. Dr. Glenn T. Seaborg, who was chairman of the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, put it this way. We must stay strong, keep trying, and trust that freedom will win. But he said it would appear that the best condition of the world we can hope for is a continuing crisis. Dr. Harrison Brown, who is professor of geochemistry at the California Institute of Technology here in Pasadena, said, because no workable solution to the arms race is in sight, the most we can expect by continued vigorous participation in the arms race is a postponement of the fateful day. A Look magazine article entitled The Next 25 Years put it this way, some facts about the next 25 years are certain. There will be risk and burdens and hardship for the challenges of the 60s, the constant threats to freedom, the opportunities for chaos and crisis show no sign of lessening even then. Former President Kennedy said, we live in the most dangerous time in the history of the human race. We are destined, all of us here today, to live out most, if not all, of our lives in uncertainty and challenge and peril. Professor Samuel Eliot Morrison, who is a leading historian, said, we have got to get used to living without solutions. President Johnson said, this will be a disorderly planet for a long time. And so it goes. Not very hopeful predictions for the future, are they? And most people are convinced by them. Most people are convinced there's no need to worry, nothing's going to work out all right. And so you see millions of hapless humans standing around as if they're sort of waiting. Waiting for the parade to begin, and then waiting for it to get over, and then waiting for the next one to start. Standing around and waiting for something to happen. Teenagers ask, why are you standing here on this corner in the strip? Said, oh, we're just sort of hanging around to see what's going to happen. And you know, you can take a look at teenagers in their sort of whiling away of time and going up and down Main Street or frequenting the malt shops or the corner drugstores or what have you in a sort of a gangland fashion of standing around hip-shot and one thumb hooked in their back Levi pocket, wondering what's going to happen. Sort of portraying or characterizing humankind in general today, we're sort of hanging around waiting to see what's going to happen. Too few people are doing anything about it. And we refuse to face reality. We can't cope, we admit, with the world the way it is. And we wonder if the world is still going to be here tomorrow. And most people are pretty well convinced it's not going to be. And so they're seeking some kind of escape from it here and now. But believe it or not, as much as people don't want to believe good news, and why shouldn't they? They hope for it, they look for it, it's just that they don't hear any and they're not used to it anymore. But peace on this earth is possible, admittedly only after struggle, admittedly at the end of a long road of human experience, admittedly the path to peace is not easy, it's not promised to be. But it's sure, it's positive, and peace is going to come in the years ahead, a lot quicker than many of us like to think. There is going to come a healthy, happy, productive, wonderful world tomorrow that really solves the problems, and there exists a master plan for peace, an outline of the future that dares to look beyond the terrible problems of today and to tell you the outcome in advance, a pattern of the way of mankind in the years ahead. And the difference between this great master plan for the world tomorrow and the predictions of most people on all sides of the fence today is that this great master plan, this mapping of the course of human beings in the future to achieve world peace, admits the problems. It sees clearly the difficulties and then dares to reveal the startling solution to the chaos of this modern age. Now, you know, when you stop to think about it, most human prognostications you're used to oscillate between the wildest optimism on the one hand or the gloomiest predictions of gloom and doom on the other. Most seers tell you only of catastrophic chaos, cataclysm, destruction, and possibly the cosmicide of the human race. That's on the one hand. Sir Bertrand Russell sits back and says, I know what's going to happen. Man is going to destroy himself. The Earth's going to be a cinder, a hulk, drifting around aimlessly in space for all eternity. That's what some of them claim they firmly believe is going to occur. On the other hand, more and more scientists and industrialists and others, sometimes even anthropologists and people dealing in the humanities and universities have a hand in trying to figure the future, and so they say, I think the better human nature, the better things, the better good in mankind is going to come to the fore, and I think we're going to be just fine. And they see only more and more of everything, more and more gadgets, more and faster travel, They see more and more money, leisure, pleasure. They see a world of science and technology with computers plugged into brains and vice versa. Plastic organs instead of your own. More time off, more money in which to spend it, and more places to go. But the trouble with those ideas happens to be that none of them tend to take into account all the really big and the pressing and the urgent problems of mankind today. They seem to shut that all out and to assume that a tiny percentage of humankind can succeed in shutting out the agonized death throes of starving millions, tell the rest of the world to live in poverty and to die in poverty quietly, while 6% of the population of the earth continues to live in an ever more dizzying Disneyland of laxity, pleasure, and ease. But that's a totally impractical point of view, too. Just like the gloomy predictions about a catastrophic end of the world, World War III. Now, I have before me a booklet that maps out the course to peace and that tells you exactly how it will occur, that takes all of the problems of mankind into consideration, admits they are true, but then tells you what lies beyond and how it is going to be possible to have world government. Let me again quote that world leaders, as if with one voice, as I have said in this brief series of programs, have said what we need, and that most urgently, to put it in the words of Dr. Charles Osgood of the University of Illinois, is an enlivened search for new alternatives to war as a means of resolving human conflicts. He said, a world government may be the only permanent solution. Now, Sir Winston Churchill said in 1950, the creation of an authoritative, all-powerful world order is the ultimate aim towards which we must strive. Unless some effective world super-government can be brought quickly into action, the proposals for peace and human progress are dark and doubtful. Former President Eisenhower in the United States said in a radio-televised speech in 1960, it had become clear by 1953 that the accumulation of atomic weapons stockpiles, whose use could destroy civilization, made resort to force an intolerable means of settling international disputes. Only in the rule of law, which meant the attainment of an enduring peace with justice, could mankind hope for guarantee against extinction. And Dr. Harold Urey, Nobel Prize winner, chemistry professor at the University of California, said only world government can prevent a catastrophic World War III. Dr. Edward Teller said, a world government sustained by moral and physical force, a world government capable of enforcing worldwide law. He said that's one of our most vital needs. And Toussaint said, what element is lacking? So that with all of our skill and our knowledge, we still find ourselves in the dark valley of discord and enmity. What is it that, with all of our professed ideals, our hopes, and our skill, peace on earth is still a distant objective, seen only dimly through the storms and turmoils of our present difficulties? World leaders know that a world government is the only solution to worldwide problems and ills. And yet, again, almost as if with one voice, they admit that world government is virtually impossible. Now, in a think factory located along the Hudson River, men are there representing the sort of an intelligentsia, you might say, of our age, trying frantically to come up with some new unthinkable idea that might lead toward world peace. Collected here are leaders from all fields of modern technology, industry, commerce, business, society. And they're trying to think out in a think factory about 35 miles north of New York City, in Hudson, New York, some possible workable solution to the world's ills. This is called a sort of a reservoir of the best brains in the country. But here's what they say. Quote, experience won't serve as a guide anymore to practical affairs. The world has become too complicated. Experience says that none of the worlds we can predict, say these thinkers, for the year 2000 will work. Yet, we know that one of them will have to work if there's going to be a world. How do you like that? Experience says none of them will work. Yet, we know this got to work. That's not very good news, is it? Now, if you were going to take a good look at this world the way it really is, you couldn't leave out any facet of it. You would have to look at education, then at science and technology, at commerce and industry, at government, at the social order, and you'd have to look at religion. You would have to analyze what is each contributing and how far along the road from midst of darkened yesteryear of virtual savagery, have we come to true civilization. Now remember again that this world is really what its leaders have made it. A fellow walking along to hip or waist-high elephant grass in a Vietnamese swamp isn't there because of his own choice. His sergeant didn't start the war. His officer didn't start the war. He wonders who did. This world is what its leaders have made it, my friends, and this world's leaders are the product of this world's educational system. Now, in taking a good long look at this world's educational systems in this great master plan for world peace, you have to come to the absolute incontrovertible opinion that education today is decadent, that education today is not offering the solution, that the more truly, quote, educated, end quote, a person becomes, the more he admits he doesn't know, and the fewer answers he has. Our teenagers in our high schools and educational institutions of higher education, such as colleges and universities, are saying they simply don't know. They're telling you they can't know anything for sure. They're saying there are no absolutes. They're saying there are no definite criteria for the solution of problems. They're saying, well, now you can't prove anything. These are statements made in classroom discussions by university professors and students alike today. Said one man, in epitomizing what's going on in the college classroom, on today's education, a familiar figure on every college campus is the freshman, and he signs up for Philosophy 101, is beginning freshman philosophy class in full confidence that maybe there will be revealed to him the ultimate meaning of life and of the universe and of his place in things. Said this one analyst, his trust is compelling, and surely every good wish must accompany him as he moves from Aristotle and Plato to Descartes, Locke, Kant, Hegel, Schopenhauer, and perhaps Whitehead and Dewey, in search of the book which maps the cosmos and marks with an X the place where the treasure lies. Avidly, he opens each text and devours the early chapters, but as the conclusion nears his eye, he is already casting restless glances toward the next volume on the shelf. Once or twice, he feels the awaited moment take hold of him, but the vision soon loses its clarity and sinks back into the sea of language. There is something, wrote this analyst, of grandeur in this search, and something of delusion. It's as if, equipped with a ring of keys, one were compelled to explore a limitless mansion through door after door, and each time it opens into an empty room. And the search for the big answer takes the seeker from door to door in the belief that a knock upon the right one will admit him to ultimate reward. I had a letter the other day from a college student, one of the real big universities of California, who listens to this program and reads the Plain Truth magazine. He talked about a classroom assignment, how his philosophy professor had assigned him to read the book of Genesis, of all things, 1 Corinthians, of all things, the book of Romans, these are books from the New Testament, in case you're wondering, and another book, which I've forgotten, in the Bible. Now, then, they didn't discuss these books, but they were then, after having read them, if they read them, to discuss their own personal views on religion. He said, you know, it's just like you've been saying on the program. Every one of them had very concrete opinions about religion, but none of them knew a thing about it. One student stood up and said, well, now, we know we can't prove anything, so it shouldn't surprise us that we can't prove God's existence. And the student commented on how they were universally convinced that there were no proofs that a God existed. This is what modern-day education is convincing our students of. They are convincing our students today that there is no proof of God, and they're convincing our students of a total untruth. They're getting some kids to say there isn't any proof that you are here. Now, you talk about a dumb idea. They're getting some kids to say there is no proof that you can't know anything for sure. Hooray, we're ignorant, seems to be the criterion today. The less we can admit we know, and the more we say we don't know, the more intellectual we are. Is that true? Isn't that saying the more foolish we are, the more ignorant we become? The more brainy, the more profound, the more erudite. Somebody needs to kind of pick his own brains and wonder what he's saying. You don't say, hooray, we're ignorant, we don't know, and yet agnosticism is glorified today, but agnosticism means we don't know. People say, I'm an agnostic. They admit they don't know, and they sort of pride themselves in it. Modern education today has been found wanting. It's been tried in the balance and has been found wanting. Modern education is not giving people a goal in life. It's not answering the big question, where did you come from? What is human nature? What is man? How did man begin? Coming in the next number of the Plain Truth magazine is another article on the questions evolution cannot answer. This one deals with Archaeopteryx. And if you've never heard of Archaeopteryx, don't be surprised. Neither have your neighbors, the chances are. But Archaeopteryx, merely meaning ancient wing, is supposed to be the link between reptiles and birds. Now, a lot of people don't even know that evolution claims birds. That means little ruby-throated hummingbirds, tiny little creatures that can hover, dart, swoop, and even fly backward, along with huge albatross that have this, listen, a 12-foot wing spread. Came from slithering lizards. That's what they claim. Now, a 12-foot wing spread, that's like standing a 4-foot-11-inch man on the top of Wilt the Stilt Chamberlain's head and then stretching out the wings of an albatross. That gives you some idea of the size of that bird. Here's a little hummingbird. Its egg is about the size of your little fingernail. Some of them so tiny they're not much bigger than an overgrown bumblebee. And here's this huge 12-foot wingspread albatross. And all of these fantastic birds, from lyre birds and all of the types that are in the exotic areas of Earth, that from the hornbill to the tiny grosbeak or to the tiny English sparrow, with which we're all familiar, they're supposed to have come from reptiles and lizards. Now, a lot of people don't realize that evolutionists tell us that these slithering lizards came ashore, they stood up, they walked, they leapt from limb to limb, and they finally learned to fly, and then finally some of them changed their minds, walked right back into the sea and kept their lungs and became the whales and the killer whales and the porpoises of the seas today. You didn't know that, probably. But science claims they once waded ashore and then waded right back out there again, and they're still there. Well, this article takes exception to some of the quotations that are taught in modern educational institutions simply because it says, now, it says, we don't know. It says, much evidence is lacking. It says, we must suppose. But then they turn right around and expect you, the layman, to accept as if it's a mysterious faith, the dogma that birds came from reptiles. Can you imagine it? The world's most rapid metabolism, little tiny light airframes with even air pockets inside the bone, an eggshell thin skull, a fantastic heartbeat, a rate of metabolism that is much faster than any other creature, and certainly much faster than man's. A tiny bird like a sparrow might eat its own weight in one day's time. So any time that somebody says he eats like a bird, well, forget it. You better not. And you compare that with the lizards and alligators and various reptiles of today, some of whose skin fairly oozes all kinds of slime, but a bird's skin must be absolutely dry. It can't even sweat, or it couldn't fly. It has to have an airframe that is incredible. What does it take to fly? You know, man with his superior intellect in all these years has finally figured out a way to make machines fly him around, but he's never sprouted wings yet, and yet he's wanted to very badly. What child is there who hasn't laying around in the front yard and looked at a little tree and thought, I wish I could do that. We want to fly. Well, people try to tell us this about evolution. Evolution's one of the biggest faiths today. So when you look at education and what it's teaching and a realistic look at this world civilization, which after all has been spawned by education, modern education has spawned the scientists, the captains of industry, of business, of the social order, the politicians, the rulers, the leaders, the theologians. So this sick, chaotic world is what the leaders have made it. And the leaders have come from the educational institutions. That ought to tell us something. In this booklet that I have before me that maps out the plan for peace and shows you how it is going to come, it's full color, free of charge, no price for it, entitled The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. In this booklet, a real look at all of these strata of society, the facet of education, of religion, of the social order, of government, of science, of technology, of commerce and industry. It's all viewed, it's all looked at squarely. and fairly, and the problems are admitted, but then beyond it is the good news of the outcome. You can take a look in this booklet of what actually will come of a happy, peaceful society. The world the way it will be, it's a master plan for peace. This is not, by the way, some idea of human beings that are trying to get you to join something like think positive thoughts and we'll all be better for it. It has nothing to do with what you do with it. You can believe it or reject it. You can laugh at it or accept it. But don't believe a word in it unless you prove it, that's for sure. Look up the sources. Check the places where we got the information. Look up chapter, text, and verse. Find out for yourself. Look at with your own eyes at all the social order around you and find out what it's like. Now, we don't need to be told about the bad news. We hear enough of that. We don't need to be told about human failure. That's all around us. We don't need to be given any more gloom and doom pronouncements because that's all you're hearing anyhow. But give this book a chance. It tells you in the first place that our standing assumption that man has reached the end of his road and there's no need worrying, nothing is going to come out all right, is not true. That there is a better world tomorrow. There is good news ahead, but it's not going to be because of man. It will be in spite of him. This booklet proves and shows you that education is decadent, that science and technology do not have the answers, that the false messiah of science today, virtually worshipped as a god by many people, who seem to feel that there's no need worrying. We've always won in the ninth inning. Somehow, something will come along and save us just in the nick of time. Science will come to our rescue just as we're about to die with an agonizing lung cancer. Science will cut out ours and give us a plastic one. People have hopes about science, medicine, technology, commerce, industry, government, the social order, religion. They hope that somehow we can escape from the reality of this present day. Well, we can't. But there is an outcome to it all. There is good news ahead, and this booklet tells you exactly what will happen. So write for it. It's free of charge. There's no price. It's entitled The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. The title is the same as this program, The World Tomorrow. Just write for the World Tomorrow booklet. And let me tell you this. People oftentimes wonder, well, who is this guy? And what is this program? And what's it all about? They recognize that it's totally different. They recognize they've never heard anything just like it. They recognize that it is totally contrary to what they might have thought in certain directions, but then, of course, if I just gave you what you always thought, there'd be no need for the program. Who wants to get bored by hearing what he himself thinks all the time? But there is no other piece of literature we have ever printed which any more succinctly and exactly tells you exactly what this program is all about, what it stands for, what it believes, what are its goals and purposes, what does it represent, than this booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What Will It Be Like? It's free of charge, there is no price, and the current number of the Plain Truth magazine is also free, no charge, it's full color throughout. All you need to do is to write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California, to receive your free copy. And there is no bill to follow, no one's going to call on you. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California, for the booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What Will It Be Like? And the Plain Truth magazine, your subscription free. There is no charge. All you need to do is to write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. And so until next time, and by the way, be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.